Well, it's good to be with you this morning, and just by a couple of words of introduction, there's a fuller bio of myself on the website that Matthew has posted there, if anyone wants to see that. But just briefly, I am the son of an Anglican priest, so I grew up in the church, in the rectory, and I served in the Canadian military as a Canadian Forces chaplain for 22 years as a Reg Force chaplain and 4 years as a reservist. I served with Robert. We never were in the same posting together, but we certainly know each other from our days in the chaplaincy. So it's good to see you again, Robert.
And
thank you. Yeah, it's good to be here. Now, I was posted here from 90 to 93. It was my first posting as a Reg Force chaplain. And I did take some services here when Richard McKenzie was on leave in the summertime a few times. So I'll have to look in the vestry book and see if I can see my signature in there. It's always fun to look back on that. So that's kind of me in a nutshell. I've retired from the military. I took a civilian parish in Ottawa for 7 years, and I just graduated. I retired from the Church of the Resurrection last summer, last July. So I've been retired almost a year. And then, of course, COVID came along, so I haven't been taking too many services. So I might be a bit rusty this morning myself, so I'll ask for your indulgence as well. Usually my wife comes with me, and we wanted to see this morning how many people were here. I didn't want somebody to not be able to worship because I brought somebody extra. But I think she's okay to come with me next week. So her name is Jillian. So that's going to be really easy for you. And it's spelt the same way as Reverend Jillian's name as well. So that should be pretty easy for you to figure out. Jesus said, "Where two or three are gathered in my name, I am there among them." This is from the gospel reading this morning. And Jesus is talking about community. I guess that's a pretty appropriate lesson, isn't it? As we come back together, as we reopen our church, as we reform our community of faith, these are pretty good words to listen to and to understand. Back in the 80s, when I was first becoming a leader in the Christian church before I was ordained, I very much enjoyed the writing of an author called Scott Peck. Peck's probably most famous book was a book called The Road Less Traveled. Some of you may have read that book. And it was written in 1978, and it's a book about the attributes that make for a fulfilled spiritual life for the individual. And then he wrote a later book, was called The Different Drum. And he wrote about, in that book, the community's spiritual journey. So The Road Less Traveled was a book about the individual's journey. The Different Drum was one about the journey of the faith community. And in that book, The Different Drum, he indicated that communities often pass through stages of development. He said that there are four stages, at least, that he identified. The first is pseudo-community, in other words, kind of fake community. Chaos. Maybe some of us have felt that during the COVID times, a little bit of chaos going on in our communities. The third stage, emptiness, and then the fourth stage of true community. And so what he said was, you know, the object for faith community should be to move to being true community. What did he mean by that? Well, the first stage, the pseudo-community, is sometimes the only stage that some communities ever get to know. In pseudo-community, everyone pretends that they're already a community and that they really know each other well, even though they might not know each other very well at all. In pseudo-community, people assure themselves that they have only superficial differences and there's no reason for deep conflict. That would never happen in the church, would it? Deep conflict. All the women are strong, all the men are handsome, and all the children are above average. And of course, the preacher is outstanding. Every sermon is interesting, or at least thought-provoking. And well, of course, these are things that would be of true community, but not all churches get to that stage. In pseudo-community, people mind their manners, no matter what they might be thinking behind their polite smile. Conversation stays general. How are you? I'm good. How are you? Oh, I'm busy. Me too. And that's about the extent that conversations cut to. A few years ago in my first parish, I asked a question of somebody on the way out of church. I said, "How are you doing?" And he looked at me warily and he said, "Do you really want to know? Or are you just making pleasant noises?" Well, that taught me a lesson, because of course I couldn't say, "No, I don't really want to know." I was the minister. So I had to say, "Yes, I do really want to know." And I had to really listen to what he was saying and go and have, pay a visit to him and make sure that I paid attention to what people were actually saying to me when I was their pastor. And of course, we all have to do that as parishioners as well, don't we? Really listen to people. He was challenging me to move out of pseudo-community into real community, to really getting to know people as opposed to thinking that I knew people. In pseudo-community, pain and conflict are avoided at all costs, and when addressed, are referenced only indirectly. When people really feel isn't shared until the meeting after the meeting. You know how that happens, the one in the parking lot, or online, or on the telephone. Afterwards, the goal of pseudo-community is a bland world of pretense where no one's feelings get hurt. When another person sins against you, you take it in silence, you seethe later with a friend, or maybe if you're really upset, you fire off a nasty email from the safety of your home computer rather than face-to-face. Isn't technology wonderful? We can do those things today. When you observe that someone has sinned against another, you shake your head, you lament their sins, and you try to mind your own business. That's pseudo-community. It's affable, but it's not very deep. It's a village of lies, really. It accepts the trade-off of some truth for a shallow peace that's rather boring, but feels safe. This morning's gospel reading, Jesus gives his view on pseudo-community. Let's listen to it again. If another member of the church sins against you, go and point out the fault when the two of you are alone. If the member listens to you, you have regained that one. But if you're not listened to, take one or two others along with you so that every word may be confirmed by the evidence of two or three witnesses. If the member refuses to listen to them, tell it to the church. And if the offender refuses to listen to the church, let that one be as a Gentile and a tax collector. It appears that tax collector was a bad word to call somebody even back then in Jesus' time. And I guess we can all relate, because I don't know how many of you have got these phone calls saying, "This is the CRA calling and you got to go out and buy some gift cards so that you can pay off your taxes." That doesn't make me feel very good about tax collectors either, even though I know it's a spoof. So clearly, Jesus calls us to be more than a pseudo-community. He calls us into true community, to be forgiven and to be a forgiving people. We should be, he says, so saturated in grace that we can risk being honest with each other. He calls us to take the risk of being truthful with each other because of the nature of sin. Now, that's kind of a churchy word, isn't it? Sin, not talked about very much today. We live in an age where people don't like to be confronted about their bad behavior and what we would call in the church sin. People charged with offenses against others, from trespassing to murder, are all pleading not guilty, even though the evidence is plain for most of us to see. When discovered or confronted with bad behavior, often people deny or minimize, blame their upbringing or their society, and ultimately, sometimes, they blame the very one who is bringing the truth to light, called victim blaming. For Jesus, sin is not a private matter between me and God. It's a public menace to the relationships among God's people. It's not just my personal business. It's the business of everyone who knows me. And that means it's worth having the occasional hard conversation about. Many of our worst conflicts in the church happen because someone had the opportunity to say, "Can we talk?" But they didn't. And things get left to fester, things remain unsolved, and sometimes that happens for years. I can remember a church I served in, somebody had said something to somebody 40 years earlier, and it was still being held against them. It wasn't forgiven, and it wasn't forgotten. I bet nothing like that's ever happened to any of you before. I heard a story a few years ago of a family who were trying to get medical care for their elderly grandfather. His health was not good. He lived on his own. He refused to go to the hospital. He refused to go to the doctor. He refused to listen to his loved ones who urged him to get some help. And in fact, he was so adamant that he wasn't going to do any of this stuff, he became resentful and angry and shouted at them, "Leave me alone. Mind your own business. None of your business." But you see, his health affected the whole family, even the whole community that the family was involved in, and everyone was worried about him. They worried that at the least he would suffer and die alone, and you know, nobody would find him for a little while. At worst, they worried that he would do something that would hurt other people, leave the stove on, or get in a car and run over somebody out on the road because he didn't see very well as well. But sometimes we need to have hard conversations, don't we, with our loved ones, with our church family, with those that we communicate with every day. Being able to do that is a sign of true community, that we have moved from being just a surface, pseudo-community into being real community where people care for one another. In a way, sin is like a splinter in your finger that needs to be removed before it becomes infected and makes the whole body weak. It hurts to have someone poke at the splinter, no doubt about it. It hurts even when we're the ones doing the poking. Point out the splinter, Jesus says. That is called love. Love for one another. Take the risk of loving truthfulness, because sin is more than individual's business. It's the business of the whole community. In the Gospel of Matthew, Jesus' words on confronting a sister or a brother who has sinned come right after the parable of the lost sheep. You remember that one where the shepherd goes off to find the one who is lost and the 99 are left behind. And it comes between that story and the one about Jesus telling Peter how many times he's to forgive another. 70 times 7, he says. And he says also to be nothing like the unforgiving servant in the parable. You know, the one who was forgiven his debt, and then he goes out and grabs somebody who owes him a very small amount and doesn't want to be forgiving of that person. Our gospel lesson this morning comes literally between those two lessons about forgiveness and about grace. It's really the filling of the essential sandwich, isn't it? Forgiveness, the confrontation of sin, and the life of grace. I know some of us, when we go on a diet, you know, we take the hamburger and say, "We don't want the bun. We'll just have the meat in the middle." But this is sort of like that, where you have this sandwich of forgiveness, of grace, and in the middle, the confrontation and the absolution, remission of sins. Loving truthfulness stands as the foundation of our faith, of our faith journey. And only forgiven sinners who have promised to forgive each other can be honest with each other and proceed in that way. Jesus calls us to tell the truth in love to one another, because sin is not just personal business. He says we should never talk behind people's backs and complain to others about what others have done, but to meet the other person directly, to meet them privately first, face to face, and then if that doesn't work, to go to other methods. If our heart is made right through prayer, if what we are seeking is the healing of relationships and not punishment or guilt trips, then we start with a simple, Can we talk? Can we go to Timmy's for a coffee? Let's talk about this. The early Methodists made a point to practice this. Members were told not to complain about their leaders behind their backs, but to share their concerns, their complaints, directly, face to face, honestly and forthrightly. And the ultimate goal, of course, within true community is peace, right relationships between other people and between God. Not easy to start or hear difficult conversations because most of us dislike confrontation. Most of us dislike uncomfortable truth. But toward the end of our reading this morning, Jesus offers us one last promise that makes it all possible for us. Where two or three are gathered in my name, I am there among you. We often take those words as an assurance that, you know, even if there's a couple of people in church, God's still going to be there with us. But he also means it in the context of all of our relationships with others in the faith community and with God. Where two or three are gathered, there I am among you. Jesus assures us that whenever we wrestle together with these things, whenever we struggle to determine how to apply discipline within our lives with graciousness, whenever we attempt to discern the right way, he will be there. He will be there to guide us. And so as we reopen our churches this Sunday, and especially this church here of All Saints, as we start coming together again, with some of the regulations that we have to go by for now, let us remember to always speak to one another in truth and in love and in thankfulness so that we can be true community. True community where care for one another is paramount. Jesus says, "Where two or three are gathered in my name, I am there among you." Thanks be to God. Amen.